Welcome into a Friday morning edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. We are talking an exhilarating, a heart-stopping, a season-saving 120-119 win over the Detroit Pistons, thanks to some brilliance from Spencer Dinwiddie and his buddies Joe Harris and Jared Dudley. We'll get into that next on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast. I am your host, Gavin Shaw, and I am joined, as always, by the GOAT, the Joshua Bass. Josh, you have to be happy right now. That was such a good game. You were sending me texts in all caps about Dinwiddie last night. I kept texting you back. I haven't watched yet. Stop spoiling it for me. And you kept sending them to me, and I really did appreciate it once I realized what Spencer Dinwiddie did.
Gavin, I am so happy right now because that, as you mentioned in your great cold open, that was, I think, a season-changing win. The Nets got off to a great start, as they do, I'd say, about 60% of the time, opened up a double-digit lead in the first quarter, gradually blew that, were down by 7 to 10 for most of the third quarter into the fourth quarter, and that's where I picked up live and starting in the fourth quarter. And Spencer Dinwiddie just took them home and got the victory for the Nets in overtime. His shot-making was insane, and that's the kind of game that we know he can have, and he loves playing against Detroit, and that just made me very happy to see.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. He was talking about the end-of-game sequence, and I forgot. I think he referenced a meme directly, but I wasn't cool enough to get
it.
Yeah,
the Hooded Kermit meme. That's actually one of my favorites. I'm surprised you don't know that.
No, I know it. I forgot what it was. I know Hooded Kermit. It's like do something bad and then you like do it and then you're like Hooded Kermit told me to, but then you robbed a bank, so it doesn't work. But in this case it was awesome because like it was Spencer Dinwiddie taking that step back three, and I usually I dislike that shot because he's been using it a lot this year at the end of shot clocks, and like instead of trying to drive into the lane, and I get it to a degree because sometimes like a shot clock is running down and you get into the lane and then you don't actually have time to pass it out and it's pointless because they can just double you, and maybe that's the best shot you can get, but he's been doing it a lot, I think, needlessly, and it frustrates me. But he made a great one in overtime, and what I did like the most about it was usually when he takes that shot, he's like a couple feet beyond the line already, and then he's like sidestepping and stepping back. In this case, he got in front of the three-point line, then stepped back, so the shot wasn't like unnecessarily far, and I thought it was done brilliantly.
It also looks really cool.
Yeah, when it works.
Coolest-looking shots in the NBA.
It's epic. I mean, didn't Harden essentially invent that move last season? Like the side step back?
Yeah, maybe not last season, maybe like his first season or two in Houston.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something where you didn't see it a lot in 5 years. 5 years ago. I feel like Harden and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, they all do it.
Yeah. I think Steph tried to do it on the famous shot he missed against Kevin Love in the 16 finals. Like he did. I totally forgot about it. But yeah, he did that move to a degree. Yeah, and then Dinwiddie, I mean, it was the shot-making. It was like that deep 3-2 at the end of regulation. That was just epic. Even before that, he had a play in the fourth quarter where he just kind of dribbled circles around Zaza Pachulia, like got by him, kind of pulled him back on the leash and said, all right, come out to the free throw line with me, and then just blew by him for a layup. And it was the second game in a row he just made a big man look stupid. I forgot he did it to someone in Cleveland. He did it to Enes Kanter against the Knicks. And he's been really good the last couple of games. And the guy who's starting ahead of him, D'Angelo Russell, just a 3-for-15 night. Josh, I'll leave it up to you. We can talk the game in general, what the win means, excuse me. Or we could talk about that debate a little bit, and maybe if there should be a shift of the guard in terms of point guard minutes and point guard role long term.
Why not both?
Oh wow!
I think the game means a lot. I mean, if the Nets had lost this, they would have been 2-6. But, I mean, Detroit is a pretty good team, and they're not the best matchup for the Nets just because Andre Drummond and Blake Griffin really can wear you down. And they have a couple other guys that can make shots. I mean, I feel like Ish Smith always plays fairly well against the Nets. So it was a good win just because the Nets were able to come out against a playoff-caliber team on their home floor, highly contested game, and be able to pull out that win. And these are the types of games you need to win at home if you want to even have a chance to crack the playoffs. So Obviously, big shot making from Dinwiddie. They just did just enough to win. I don't think the Nets played terrible. Honestly, just so many ticky-tack fouls were called that really allowed Detroit to rack up a lot of points at the free throw line because they only shot 42% from the field. But, you know, this is the type of win you need, and good job by the Nets for really toughing it out when it looked pretty dire there in the third and fourth quarter.
Yeah, I want to give credit to some of the supplementary guys because on a night where D'Angelo Russell was terrible and Alan Crabb was, not unexpectedly absent. Shabazz Napier didn't do anything. I thought Karis had a very solid game, even though, and this is maybe an indictment on where my expectations are for him because he had 19 points, 6 rebounds, 6 assists, and 2 steals, but I don't think he played great. Like, I want to give credit to Joe Harris and Jared Dudley because I thought they were just so essential to the Nets staying in this one. Harris, in particular, was extraordinarily efficient, 23 points on just 14 shots. I know his three-point shooting continues to just be incredible, but even beyond that, like, his first step is still so impressive to me. Like, obviously, we talked last year about his ability to get to the rim and finish around the basket being shockingly good. But I think he really took it up a level this offseason. Last year, he really mostly attacked against scrambling defenses, and he's still not like a one-on-one ISO wizard or anything, but he's gotten to the point where he's quick enough where even if a guy is relatively well set, if he gets the right switch, he can attack someone off the dribble, and he was really, really effective with it. Dudley didn't shoot the ball that well, but he made a big three-pointer in overtime and was able to get to the line for 6 free throws, which is really a rarity for him. I love the way he attacked the basket. I thought he made some really smart passes. Defensively, I thought he made some very, very smart plays in help. I think this game just really showed off his intelligence and the reason why he's still a positive value and had the second best plus minus on the team, even though he played 38 minutes and shot 2 for 9 from the field.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I think Jared Dudley might have had one of the better 2 for 9 games you'll ever see out of a role player. He was almost the GOAT with those 2 really bad missed threes when he was wide open at the end of regulation that could have given the Nets the win without going to overtime, but he hits the big 3 at the end of OT to tie it back up. Had some really nice defensive plays also. I think he thought he did a good job banging with Blake Griffin. And the last play of regulation, I think it was Reggie Jackson driving to the hole. Rondé did a nice job of cutting him off. And then Jared Dudley, knowing that Reggie Jackson doesn't have time to make a pass to anyone just because the shot clock would expire, comes over with the excellent help, makes it impossible for Reggie to get that basket. So really smart play from him. And then Joe Harris just is so good. I mean, between Joe Harris and Spencer Dinwiddie, I think the Nets have 2 of the guys who were marginal NBA players at the start of their career and have made the biggest improvements into really good role players and even starting caliber guys.
I think it's so funny that at this point last season, you and me were genuinely having the Joe Harris, Alan Crabb debate. Like, that was like a real conversation, and we'd bring it up maybe too often. And I think we both pretty quickly shifted over to the Joe Harris side. But just the fact that that was an argument and the fact that, for literally all of last year, the Nets started Crabb over Harris, and you can argue that maybe they knew Harris was better and the roles were just such that it was more convenient for Harris or made more sense for Harris to come off the bench. But it just, you look at them now and they're just like not even in the same stratosphere.
Yeah, also a lot of that is just because Crabb is so bad now.
Yeah, for sure.
He was getting sunned by Calderon.
I wrote that in my notes.
Right now is G League caliber.
I wrote down in like all this is and this is handwriting, so I usually don't use all caps, but I wrote down in all caps, Jose Calderon is better right now than Alan Crabb, and I'll stick by that. I genuinely believe that, and that's a sad state of affairs. All right,
I'm surprised you could read your own handwriting.
I'm
reading it back because Gavin. Yeah. For anyone that doesn't know or didn't go to high school with us, which is 100% of you.
Marcus. What about Marcus?
99% of you. Gavin has probably the worst handwriting I've ever seen from a human being.
I'm gonna say
or animal.
Miko the dog is slightly better than me. I'll give him credit for that. But I think it's gotten a little better with time. Actually, I don't know. Maybe I was just using a good pen today. I was marveling at my own handwriting. I'm like, this is like very readable, and this is like fairly like I was using straight lines. It was strange. Anyways.
Send a picture to me after this.
Yeah, I will text it. You're not going to be impressed with it because it was like quickly, but I don't know. I thought it was fine. All right, I'll text it to you though. Okay, that wraps up our initial segment of Locked On Nets. When we come back, we'll go over the rest of the team, the point guard battle, and any other notes we found interesting from this Nets win. We'll have that next for you on Locked On Nets. Peak ticket season in New York is fast approaching, and we know that you want to be a part of it. The NFL is in full swing, the Yankees are getting ready for a playoff run, and hockey and basketball are just around the corner. And there's no better option to get a great deal on attending any of those events than Vivid Seats. Vivid Seats allows you to sort by price or look for seats in the section and row of your choice. To make things even better, Vivid Seats is giving listeners an exclusive promo code for $20 off orders of $200 or more to save you even more money. Go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. Then use promo code LOCKEDON for $20 off orders of $200 or more. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app and enter promo code LOCKEDON for $20 off orders of $200 or more. That's LOCKEDON. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime and let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. We are back on the Locked On Nets podcast. It honestly, Josh, it's such a weight off my shoulders doing this podcast after like a Nets win. Like I can just sense that you're happier. I'm a little bit more relaxed. It's just a good feeling. So I wanted to really embrace that and enjoy it. It was a 120-119 victory over the Detroit Pistons. And we got into it a little bit, but I want to have the conversation with you. Does this game shift your opinion at all on Spencer Dinwiddie and D'Angelo Russell? And again, maybe that's an overreaction. I'm admittedly biased towards Dinwiddie and predisposed to thinking he is the better point guard. And like every time after D'Lo has a great game and Dinwiddie's kind of meh, I'm like, all right, Dinwiddie was just off. He'll get it back. And I'm like, D'Lo, this isn't sustainable. And when Dinwiddie does it, I think the opposite. So maybe I'm off on this. But to me, like the whole body of work over the last two seasons, I just think Dinwiddie, is clearly better. And maybe the way they're doing it in this game where D'Lo started and Dinwiddie closed is the best way to do it. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much aligning with you. Everyone knows that I'm not the biggest fan of D'Angelo Russell, but at the same time, I mean, he was terrible last night, but he has been really good the last few games. The three-point shot has looked good, especially off the catch. It wasn't falling against the Pistons. I thought there were some problems with shot selection, a couple of forced passes, but it doesn't mean that there should change the starting lineup. Let's at least see what happens. You have to give it 20 games or so, and we've mentioned it all the time. D'Angelo Russell, this is going to be his year to either make it or break it. So the Nets have to give him every chance to see if he can develop into that star point guard of the future. And if not, maybe around the All-Star break, you start looking to say, hey, Spencer Dinwiddie, we're going to give you the keys to the car now. But what's Dinwiddie averaging? He's averaging 28 minutes a game this year. So it's not like he's a sparsely used reserve off the bench. So it's not like he's Theo Pinson. So
yeah, no, he's definitely.
I think that regardless, the minutes are going to be pretty even.
Yeah, that's 100% fair. And You see D'Lo is essentially at the same point this season, also at 28 minutes a game. So, yeah, they're pretty much playing the same amount of time. I just wonder if that should shift in a direction where Dinwiddie's playing 32-33 and D'Lo's playing 23-24. And D'Lo, it's tough because it seems like he had like a solid game. Like either he's like spectacular, he's incandescent, he's making like 6-7 threes, or he's really struggling like he did tonight. So I think Dinwiddie, I just think the ceiling's lower with Dinwiddie, but the floor is as well. And I think I'm not even sure if the ceiling's lower. I just think the floor is higher with Dinwiddie.
The ceiling is the roof, as Michael Jordan once said. But I think that it's a good point with D'Lo. A lot of that's because he doesn't get to the free throw line at all. I mean, one free throw attempt against Detroit, he just doesn't really look for contact and will often pull up for a floater instead of taking it all the way to the basket. And that's why this year, even though he shot the ball pretty well, he's only averaging two free throw attempts a game, which for someone like him who has the ball in their hands as much as he does, should be way higher.
Yeah. No, 100%. And we've harped on that enough, so we don't have to go further into it. I guess a final parting thought is I think Dinwiddie should clearly be playing more minutes than D'Angelo Russell. All right, let's talk about the two-headed combination at center. Ed Davis and Jared Allen, they give up a ton on the boards this game. It felt like every time the Nets play the Pistons, where Andre Drummond and Blake Griffin were just playing volleyball, and to be fair, they do that against most teams. Offensively, though, I like the effort from the duo. They combine in, again, they combine 40 minutes for 24 points and 19 rebounds, which, again, considering the opposition, like, I'll take those numbers every time. And part of that, the rebounding numbers, I think, were a little inflated because the Pistons got up so many shots, partially because they were getting a lot of offensive rebounds. But still, I think after a tough start for both of those players, particularly Allen, who got pulled after two very quick fouls, I thought they rebounded nicely and had pretty good games.
Yeah, I mean, they combined for 9 offensive rebounds. The Nets had more offensive rebounds than the Pistons, and it doesn't feel that way. Obviously, there was one possession where the Nets got, I think, 4 offensive rebounds.
At least, yeah.
In one trip down the court. I thought they did as good a job as they could. I mean, Drummond is just an animal. He's a physical specimen, and it's really hard to keep him off the boards. He had 10 offensive rebounds. I think 6 of those came from 2 possessions where he just kept batting the ball to himself. But, you know, they did as good a job as they could. It's not the best matchup. And there were a lot of times where they just had to, they got either got called for ticky tack fouls or, I don't know, the refs, I thought, called the game pretty tight. Allen, he had a decent game. He had some nice finishes inside, struggled to enforce his will on the defensive end. But I liked what I saw from him. He missed those 2 free throws at the end of the game, costly, but he came back with a couple buckets. He had that nice and one on the reverse layup. So I think this was a good game for him all around. What do you think about Davis not playing the overtime and them? Kenny electing to go with RHJ at the center.
Yeah, I don't necessarily get it. I just think that's like not necessarily sustainable against the combination of Drummond and Griffin. It did lead to one of my favorite sequences of the game where they had that little like pick and roll where Hollis Jefferson, like, it's weird to describe it, like, he like sent a pick up top for Dinwiddie, then like shifted to the other side of the court, ran one with Caris LeVert, slipped it, got into the lane and made that like beautiful like jump pass over into the corner to Dudley at the last possible second to get him a wide open 3. So there are those little like moments of like skill ball where you're like, oh, okay, that was awesome. Like, that's why you have him out there. And that's like a play, like, if you're going to have Andre Drummond in the game against him or Blake Griffin in the game against him, like, they're not going to be able to defend that. But conversely, you just get wrecked on the other end by rebounding. So I thought it was kind of an unnecessary risk. And with as solid as Davis is and just how smart of a player he is, like, I kind of would want to see him out there in that situation. And I think if Hollis Jefferson was just playing out of his mind, like, you put him in, but he hasn't been.
Yeah, if Rondé's on fire, you keep him in. But I thought, I mean, I think the thing is, Davis obviously has his limitations. He can't shoot threes, but neither can Rondé. And I think if you're in that spot, it might make sense. And who am I to question Kenny Atkinson because they got the win? But it makes sense to have Davis, who can really bang on the boards and give you second chances also, in addition to doing a better job clearing the glass against Detroit, and provide more of a role man that can kind of dive to the basket and have explosive finishes, as opposed to someone like Rondé Hollis-Jefferson, whose game is more in that 7 to 12 foot range. So I would have gone with Ed Davis. I can't fault Kenny Atkinson too much because it worked out, but I was definitely not too happy about that when I saw Rondé take his position at center to start overtime as opposed to ED.
Yeah, I guess the logic there, and again, this kind of falls apart when you realize like Davis like didn't really play like a large minute load, so he could have been active, but I guess like he just figured Detroit was going to be exhausted by that point in the game, and Hollis Jefferson plays with so much energy and hadn't played all that much, so maybe he could have provided a spark. Obviously, in the end, whether or not it was because of RHJ playing, it worked out for the Nets. All right, I guess, do you have any final thoughts on this game? That's pretty much everything.
Yeah, I think the Nets didn't play terribly. Just a couple of times where they were pretty out of rhythm on offense, and that allowed Detroit to get back in it. I thought Napier in his minutes really struggled with just kind of all over the place, rushing, not really sharing the ball, a couple of bad shots. So I've liked what I've seen from him so far, but this game was definitely not his finest. Hopefully he can get back on track against Houston. But I think good effort all around, and obviously love to see the heroics from our boy Spencer.
Yeah, to your point, and a lot of this occurred during the stretch that Napier was in there, the Pistons, like, against the Nets backups, which, again, theoretically an advantage, but haven't played great together as a unit. It's mostly been like the starters mixed with the backups that have been pretty effective. They got outscored. Well, it wasn't just the backups, but they had a run where they got outscored 23-3, and that kind of flipped the game and allowed the Pistons to be up for most of the game. And I thought, like, again, just because we're focusing mostly on the positive in this podcast, I think it's worth mentioning, like, for long stretches of this game when Detroit was dominating, the Nets had a lot of issues with communication on both sides of the ball. You just saw the same stupid turnovers we saw so many times against the Knicks, and even in some of their better games against the Warriors and Pelicans, where guys just weren't on the same page. And then defensively, like, I thought there were some real issues with pick and roll coverage, and like a bunch of times they ended up giving Blake Griffin open threes because like Dudley like wasn't, like, maybe like it was Dudley's job to fight through it, or he miscommunicated the switch. But I just think the Nets have a lot of room to get sharper in some very obvious ways. And to me, that's almost an encouraging sign, because I think all of that stuff is fairly coachable.
Yeah, winning a game where you shot 12 of 38 from three against an opponent that probably has the two best players on the court is huge for the Nets. I mean, it's not going to – is it going to change the season? Are they going to win now 35 games instead of, 25? No, it's not going to be that big of a difference. But these are all positive signs, especially after getting absolutely embarrassed by the Knicks.
Yep, I'm 100% with you. I want to give a quick shout-out to Blake Griffin. I think he's awesome, and I think he's wasted in Detroit. There were so many times where he just – broke into the lane and threw these beautiful like pinpoint corner passes just to watch like his like crappy teammates miss wide open threes. So shout out to Blake Griffin. Shout out to you, Josh. We will have one more segment, and we will talk about the Nets facing the Houston Rockets and the return of Rodions Karutz, that next on the Locked On Nets podcast. We are back one final time. Locked on Nets. The Nets get a dub, and now they take on a team that, as we mentioned when I was trying to cheer you up after that brutal, brutal Knicks loss, a team that the Nets are better than so far this season. It is the Houston Rockets. Somehow the team that was in the regular season, by a pretty significant margin, the best team in basketball. I think they had like a plus like 12, 13, 14 scoring margin last year. They are minus 10.3 so far this season, and they are very close to being in a not-so-great company with the Phoenix Suns as being the only team in the league bottom 25 in both offense and defense. I think they're 24th in offense, 25th in defense. And obviously part of that is due to James Harden missing a couple games and Chris Paul missing a couple games. But still, all in all, a stunning fall from grace for one of the best teams in basketball.
Yeah, I mean, we see really how much depth matters in the NBA. Losing a guy like Trevor Ariza, who is really, I mean, kind of an unsung hero for the team. Just his very solid three-point shooting, and then also being a good team defender, someone who could also get out in transition as well. Luke Richard and Bob Mute was very good for them last year. Now they're replacing those two guys with James Ennis, who's been pretty inconsistent. And obviously Harden missing time, CP3 missing time, and obviously that whole brawl that happened with the Lakers. They're out of sorts right now, but I think they're a very talented team. The Nets certainly shouldn't and can't take them lightly, because if they do, I think CP3 could drop 45 on them.
Yeah, no, 100%. And even though I think he might be taking a step back this year, which is scary because the Rockets, I think, owe him like $150 million or something. Yeah, he's still more than good enough to torch his team. And don't you just, like, I know Harden is, I think, probably out for this game.
Yeah, he's doubtful.
Yeah, I just see this like being like it's typical Nets luck. Like I just think this is gonna be the game where Houston puts it all together. Like James Ennis makes like 6-7 threes. It just feels like they're due for a great game even without Harden. So I can see this one being tough on the Nets. But again, without Harden, there's no reason that shouldn't be very competitive, and maybe even you could say shouldn't win this game.
Yeah, Ennis hasn't played the last few, so I'm not sure if he'll be back in. But
he'll do it from the bench.
If he's not, expect Isaiah Hardenstein to maybe drop 30.
Or Zochi.
Yeah, Zochi, Rio Grande's finest.
The GOAT. All right, and then the other big piece of news for the Nets is Rodions Karutz is expected to make his return in this game, and we were talking about this off-air, but we are both of the opinion that he should be taking Allen Crabbe's minutes, and you should shift Allen Crabbe out of the rotation, and it should be that simple, and there shouldn't really be any more thought put to it than that.
Yeah, I just hope that Kurtz gets enough playing time. I want to see him in that 10 to 15 game minute role. And it's not to say that you should completely eradicate Allen Crabbe from the rotation. Maybe just give him a couple more games. If he keeps playing that poorly, then do it. But he should see his minutes reduced, no question. And maybe that'll be a wake-up call for the guy. But I think Kurtz had a nice spark his first three games with the Nets. Made a lot of impact plays. Made some boneheaded plays, but When you look at his overall impact, it was positive. So excited to see him back out there, and I think he gives them a nice something.
Yeah, I just think Crabbe is so in his head right now, and that's really what it seems like. He's just going through.
Such he's a in my feelings challenge.
Yeah, no, I know. Maybe you're right. Like maybe he'll get like an FU attitude, and like it'll turn him around. But I almost feel like giving him less minutes will just like again just further erode his confidence. But again, this is the NBA. He's making $17 million a year, so that's and it sucks because like I feel for the guy. Like I'm sure, like obviously, I'm sure he's working his hardest to be playing well, but. I just don't think it's what's currently happening is sustainable. And Karutz, like in my mind, is again like the total opposite. Like probably like I mean who knows what he's going to be. So I'm not going to comment on his talent level. But you would think at least at this point shouldn't be a better NBA player than Allen Crabbe. But just with how confident he's playing and how aggressively he's playing, he is a much better player than Allen Crabbe. So I'm pretty set in that opinion.
Yeah, I mean I want to slow the brakes a little bit just because we've seen Karutz play about. Like 40 career minutes.
That's enough.
Yeah, it's enough for you. 1 minute was enough for you.
Yeah, I was in.
But I don't know. They need to figure out what to do with Crabbe because the guy still has another year left on his contract after this at $18 million, and he's not going to go away because no one will take him.
Yeah, definitely not at this point. All right, on that somber note, for what was a mostly optimistic podcast, we will wrap this one up. Thank you so much for tuning in. I gotta check with Josh, but I believe we will be back and dropping a pod on Sunday night for all of you, and you'll have that in your feed again either late on Sunday or Monday morning. I apologize for the minimal amount of episodes this week. I have an extraordinarily busy work schedule. Josh always has a busy work schedule, so we're going to do our best over the next couple of weeks. We might go down from 5 pods to maybe 3 or 4, but again, we are going to do our absolute best to bring you as many as we can. So thank you so much for tuning in and being patient with us. Until then, be well. We'll talk to you soon.